that you have a team of people, and the more you broadcast the voices of the community, that whole community rallies around you. You are definitely not alone. That's the power of community media.
That's Amy Goodman, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Amy Goodman on the power of community media. In a time of polarized politics, the role of independent community media play an increasingly important role. Big media are owned and controlled by large corporations. Their salient interest? To make as much profit as possible for their shareholders. That is its political economy. Given that acute limitation, it makes it difficult for most people to get information that challenge mainstream perspectives. By featuring diverse voices and views largely excluded, community-based media provide an alternative to corporate McNews. To talk about the power of community media is one of its foremost practitioners, Amy Goodman. She's the award-winning host of Democracy Now!, the daily syndicated radio and TV program. Howard Zinn said of her, "Amy Goodman has carried the muckraking tradition of Upton Sinclair, George Seldes, and I.F. Stone into the electronic age, creating a powerful counter to the mainstream media." She gave the keynote address of the National Federation of Community Broadcasters meeting in mid-June in Salt Lake City. And now, Amy Goodman.
It is so wonderful to be here to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the NFCB, of the National Federation of Community Broadcasters. How many? The oldest and largest national organization dedicated to community stations within the public media system. This is our neighborhood. But really, the whole world is. That's the power of media. I see the media as a huge kitchen table that stretches across the globe, that we all sit around and debate and discuss the most important issues of the day. It is our job to go to where the silence is. Often it is not silent. It is rowdy. It is raucous. People are organizing, but it doesn't hit the corporate media radar screen. It's our job to go there. That's the power and why there is no more important moment than right now. You all represent the hope of the future. You all are the clergy of a sanctuary of dissent. And dissent is what will save us. Public media, even the corporate media, is under attack because all media is essential to the functioning of a democratic society. And ultimately, that's what's under attack. And so you have to take apart the pieces. You've got to unbuild those building blocks. The absolute foundation of a democratic society. But that's not the only story that's going on here. It's all of the people around this country who are fighting back. And that is our role, to give voice to those who are organizing. How many times corporate networks call us, can I have that number, can I have that number, can I have that number? Because, you know, they go to their self-appointed leaders, or so often you just get that same tired small circle of pundits on these networks who know so little about so much, explaining the world to us and getting it so wrong. I think the power of Democracy Now! And the stations, the programs on all of your stations, is people closest to the story telling their stories. That's the hard work. But it isn't as hard as one might think, because community radio stations are made up of those people. and that's what's so important, who may not have access to the corporate media, but who make their way through the training programs, through the open doors of community media, and we can't let those doors close. We've got to keep the microphones on. You know, I've often criticized the corporate media for being a stenographer to those in power. But even they, right now, are balking, to say the least, as one network after another, from CBS being sued by President Trump for billions of dollars for editing an interview with Kamala Harris, for editing a long interview where she's got allergies and she's coughing and she's sneezing. You know, we sort of, this is our standard practice in newsrooms when you have to cut an hour interview to 10 minutes. I can think of all the times I'm standing telling someone, no, you need to cut another minute out. And it's not for political content. It's to, you have to get something because there are so many people that need to speak. So that was not going to go anywhere, that suit. Except if media outlets, the most powerful ones, are owned by corporations that are owned by corporations that are hoping to merge with other corporations, they have far more interest than a newsroom, which probably doesn't make them the most money. And so they have other concerns. And even if they know, they're going to win that battle in court. But they can win the battle and lose the war. And the war for them is merging with another company that will make their shareholders more money. This is the real problem with corporate media, and a real problem when they are the ones who are supposed to be the standard bearers of freedom of the press. They're just caving for their economic interests. Or you have ABC. George Stephanopoulos, right? He says on television, one of their star hosts, that President Trump was found guilty of rape in a trial. And so President Trump sued. Now, what is true is while it was a civil trial found liable for sexual assault, the judge in the case said, in common parlance, that is known as rape. ABC could have taken this way up the judicial chain, but they felt even if they could have easily won that, they would lose so much more money around their corporate investments. Look at people like Bezos, who owns the Washington Post. Of course, he owns Amazon, too. One of the billionaires standing at President Trump's inauguration, when they're going to endorse Kamala Harris, said, no, we're going to stop endorsing presidential candidates, right, in the lead up to the elections. Now, I think there's a lot of arguments to made for and against endorsements. I think that's a legitimate point. But if the reason the publisher of the Los Angeles Times and the publisher like Bezos of the Washington Post doesn't want the endorsement is simply because it might go against the person who will win and they want to be in good standing with him, that is a very serious problem. We have so much work to do, and you are the standard bearers as nonprofit media of that critical pursuit of truth. And what I also want to say is, it's not exactly truth with a capital T. People have so many truths, and it's that diversity that we also celebrate and provide a platform for, that we all learn from. If we don't know people personally, how do we learn about them? We hear them or watch them in the media. And that's how we learn about other countries. That's how other countries learn about us. And it's absolutely critical that that lens be something other than a corporate lens, how we're projected to the rest of the world and how the rest of the world sees us. That is a matter of national security. Why, what you're doing here is so noble, is so important. It's a matter of life or death of this democracy in the United States today. I don't think that's too much to say. Who is in our community? Who do we get to know? People we'll never meet in person, but we hear them speaking. Maybe ideas we absolutely disagree with. But, oh, that's why they think what they do. Which reminds me, one year of the Nobel Peace Prizes, we were broadcasting from Stockholm. And we spent a week and we talked about Sweden, you know, is the home of the Nobel Peace Prize. And of course, Alfred Nobel is the inventor of dynamite. We talked all about that, that history. It is the second largest weapons manufacturer in the world. It's hard to believe that place that the great Swedish climate activist Greta Thunberg just went home to after she went on that Gaza flotilla and tried to break the Israeli blockade on Gaza with a dozen other activists and a journalist. Absolutely amazing. And you might know and actually have heard the voice of this young woman talking to us from the Gaza Freedom Flotilla as if she were in our studio. That's what they all want to shut down. That's what we all have to fight for. Because let's be clear, I really do think whether we're talking about the Israel-Palestine conflict, whether we're talking about larger issues of war and peace, whether we're talking about racial justice, economic inequality, LGBTQ issues, whether we're talking about the environment, those who care about these issues are not a fringe minority. They're not even a silent majority. They're the silenced majority, silenced by the corporate media, which is why we have to take the media back. That's why the National Federation of Community Broadcasters is so important. Each one of your stations is so absolutely critical. That those voices of dissent, those voices you hear around the water cooler, become commonplace. They are not dangerous. They're essential. Whether you're a Palestinian woman doctor who's lost 9 members of her family, or an Israeli peace activist whose mother and father were killed October 7th, you are hearing what they have to say as they actually unite. And they talk about fighting for peace, whether we're talking about a Palestinian child, an Israeli grandmother, an uncle in Afghanistan, a child in Salt Lake City. We are breaking down barriers and caricatures when people speak for themselves. The media can be the greatest force for peace on earth. Instead, it is all too often wielded as a weapon of war, which is why we have to take the media back. And it is most often wielded in that way by the silence, by the voices you don't hear. I remember in the lead up to the Iraq War, when most people in this country were opposed to Bush's war on Iraq, right? It came out of 9/11. Were there any Iraqi hijackers of those 19? How is it possible that that justified the war in Iraq? And how is it possible that when the networks covered that war, how rarely we heard an Iraqi voice? I'm not talking about the leaders. I'm talking about people on the ground. Netanyahu, the prime minister of Israel, knows the power of those voices, which is why he has forbidden international journalists from going to Gaza unembedded. Forbidden. Most networks don't say that very much. And I want to say, there are so many journalists inside the corporate media as well. I bet many of them came from community radio stations who are committed. But they get funneled, we call it up, and suddenly they find themselves, sometimes they think, well, I could reach millions of people, so this is worth it, the compromises that are made. And some of them fight royal battles inside their news organizations, and some of them leave, and some of them stay and try to do the best they can do. Mahmoud Khalil. He was taken, I think, on March 8th, you know, the graduate student at Columbia University, so this was soon after that. The Trump administration's nationwide roundup of international students accused of holding opinions it dislikes is picking up speed, sowing fear, separating families, driving people to go underground or out of the country. This targeting appeals to President Trump and his followers as it bolsters three pillars of the MAGA movement. It attacks universities, long reviled as a source of liberal power. It fuels the anti-immigrant fervor long promoted by people like Trump advisor Stephen Miller, who calls them invaders. Thirdly, by targeting Palestinian solidarity activists on campus, it amplifies the false narrative that criticizing the state of Israel is anti-Semitic, even though so many of the student protesters and professor protesters are Jewish. Enabling the attacks on academia while providing cover for Israel's resumed ethnic cleansing in Gaza. These students are being accused of anti-Semitism when so many of them are Jewish, and you don't have to be Jewish to care about human rights. History teaches us that standing by silently as others are disappeared is a failed strategy. As the next person grabbed off the street by masked agents of the state, maybe you. You know, I am a Jewish journalist. My grandfather was an Orthodox rabbi. He ran the Crown Heights Yeshiva in Brooklyn. He was the principal and the Yiddish rabbi there. That's on my mom's side. She went through that whole system. When she would get in trouble, she would be sent to the principal, and he'd say, "Darla, what did you do?" And she went on to U.S. high school and Jewish high school, Jewish Hebrew Theological College and Hunter College, tracked all the way through. My great-grandfather on my father's side was the Henry Street rabbi, came from an area now that's Ukraine. It went back and forth between Poland. My grandmother, the Rebbetzin, the wife of the Crown Heights rabbi, and she was born in Rivne, what's now Ukraine, was Poland. In 1897, she was a woman of three centuries. She died in 2005. She was 108 when she died. And my great-great-great-great-grandfather was the founder of Hasidism, the Baal Shem Tov. So, you know, I grew up steeped in Jewish history. I was always totally in awe of non-Jews in World War II who helped save Jews, my family, so many families. I mean, why would people risk everything, their own families, to save others who were targeted? And that was the feeling of my whole family. They're called the righteous, truly remarkable people. And that's what people, I don't even want to say human rights activists, but it is what fuels human rights activists. It's what people of compassion do. It's not about whether you're from Mexico or whether you're from Palestine. It's not about whether you're from Afghanistan. It is because someone is in trouble, someone is in pain. And I think we were all raised to believe that we have to be there. And I think that's the wave we've seen across college campuses throughout this past year. So I want to go back to Mahmoud Khalil, a Columbia University grad student until last December. He was first arrested March 8th. He was a legal permanent resident of the United States with a green card, which has now been revoked. His wife, Dr. Noor Abdullah, is a U.S. citizen. She's a dentist, about to give birth. She was at the time. She now has a little boy named Dean, Dean Khalil. That's their first child, expecting to give birth with her husband, with Mahmoud. 8 months pregnant, she filmed her husband's arrest in Columbia Housing. As she spoke to his lawyer on the phone, she tried to learn the identities of the arresting plainclothes agents as they dragged Mahmoud into an unmarked car. Mahmoud had joined the Palestine Solidarity protests at Columbia University last spring and was accepted by both the protesters and the administration as a negotiator. Right? He would go back and forth between them. He thus had a prominent public role in the first major protest encampment against Israel's ongoing assault on Gaza, which sparked encampments across the country. Very likely why he was targeted for deportation. A federal judge blocked his deportation while his legal teams fight for his release. Now, this story has, to say the least, since been updated. His wife gives birth at this people's graduation a few weeks ago of Columbia students who came to get their alternative diplomas. She cradled little Dean in her arms with a Palestinian flag on his baby graduation cap, and then immediately went down to Gina because her lawyers were fighting for her to be able to bring the baby and to see her husband for the first time, and he could touch his infant son. Don't forget, these people are not charged with crimes. In other places all over the country, of course, you can have contact visits. But they are being so punitive, it took a battery of lawyers 48 hours with Dr. Abdullah holding the baby to get an hour visit, their first visit together at the jail. Little baby he holds for the first time. And then he goes off to the immigration court, where the immigration lawyer, you know, ultimately, so many of them sadly see themselves unlike the federal judges. They're, you know, part of the executive branch. But she was shocked by what Mahmoud had to say. When you call me a terrorist and then say you're going to deport me, I face assassination at home. I face torture. I face imprisonment. And even the judge was shocked by his words, as he only turned around when he heard his baby cooing, hearing those first coos for the first time in person. I also, the next day after the people's graduation, got to go to the Columbia graduation where Mohsen Badawi graduated. Mohsen was arrested after Mahmoud. He also, a Palestinian from a West Bank refugee camp, had lived in the United States for years, was beyond green card. He was getting his citizenship right at the naturalization process, going for that interview. He's a student at Columbia, and he's called to do his naturalization interview in Vermont. This was in April. He's told to come for an interview, and he's thinking, it's early. I shouldn't be coming now. It's not for months. Is it a trap? He writes to Senator Sanders, because naturalization interviews in Vermont, to Senator Welch and to Congressmember Ballant, the three representatives of the small state of Vermont. He said, I think I'm being set up, but there's no way I can't go, because then I would be blamed for not showing up. So he shows with his lawyer. He does the whole thing. He has to sign his oath to the Constitution at the end, and it's going okay. And all of a sudden, the door bursts open. Masked, hooded agents come in, and they take him away, separated from his lawyer. He's raced to the airport. He has to go to the bathroom. He has to get a drink of water. By the time he gets to the gate, his plane is pulling away. It's a commercial jet. You know, if he had been sent to the South, he could still be there. And as that plane pulls away, the judge tells the lawyer that he is not to be removed from Vermont. So he is held in a Vermont prison, and ultimately the judge rules enraged and says, we're talking about the Red Scare. We're talking about the Palmer raids. What is happening here? He must be released. And after 14 days, he's released and comes out and says to President Trump, you know, from the steps of the courthouse, I am not afraid. I do not fear you. So he was in Vermont, and then the Columbia graduation was happening, and the judge ruled he can go to New York, could go to the graduation. So he goes to court the next day, and the judge is mad. I want to be able to read you his words, but I don't have them right here. But basically what the judge said is he not only can go to his graduation, he can meet with members of the media, he can meet with any public official he wants to, and he can protest anywhere. You leave him be. So he comes to graduation, and as he walks across the stage with his hands and the peace sign, hugging the dean, the entire Columbia, most of the Columbia class stands up and gives him a standing ovation. That is Mohsen's story. I mean, there are so many people whose stories we can tell. In one of the most disturbing incidents, Tufts University PhD student and Fulbright scholar Ramesa Ozturk was snatched off the street in Somerville outside Boston by half a dozen masked ICE agents as she was walking to dinner with, going with friends to break the daily fast during Ramadan. She's in Somerville, right outside Tufts. The abduction caught on a neighbor's doorbell camera. A chilling demonstration of the brutal tactics being used against this vulnerable population. The day after her arrest, over 1,000 people, professors, students, community members, turned out to protest near Tufts. Tufts also issued a letter, but this mass rally demanding her release. You know, when they moved in on her, she said, "I'm calling the police." She had no idea who these masked people were. And they said, "We are the police." She would later tell her lawyer that one of them said, you know, afterwards, she didn't even know she had screamed. She didn't even know that's instinct to save yourself. But she told her lawyer that one of the men holding her said, "We are not monsters. We are following orders." Think about that. And that's where community media comes in. As I said, a huge kitchen table that we all sit around. And why is this most critical? Also for the service members, for law enforcement, for all the people who are asking questions inside the system. They identify as well. If they hear these voices, it is our noble responsibility, an awesome responsibility that we have. This is clearly not just a job. It is a mission. So back at Columbia, right before the graduation, the protests continued. About a dozen Jewish students, the encampments were over now, but a dozen Jewish students chained themselves to two campus gates, Aharon Dardik, an Israeli-American student, saying, "We as Jewish students said that we weren't going to leave until the university named who it was amongst the trustees who collaborated with the fascist Trump administration to detain our classmate, Mahmoud Khalil, and tried to deport him." That's what Aharon said. Among the signs that the students held and the professors who were supporting them, one read, "First they came for Mahmoud." A reference to Pastor Martin Niemöller's famous saying from Nazi Germany that ends, "And I said nothing. Then they came for me, and there was no one left to speak out."
You're listening to Amy Goodman on the Power of Community Media. This is Independent Alternative Radio. For copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org.
Which brings me to the enormous assault on the LGBT community right now around this country. I come from New York, and it was a Thursday when we heard that the Trump administration had just wiped from the Stonewall, it's a federal site now, you know, the launch of the modern day gay rights movement, LGBTQ movement, had erased the letter T from LGBTQ. Erase the T. Who led the Stonewall riot, as it's called, when police moved in on this little bar in the village? Oh, people like Sylvia Rivera. These were trans women with their spiked heels who took off their heels and they were hammering on the police to let them go. They sparked this modern day movement. They were the trans women who sparked the movement. And now they were erasing the T. So you are not to say LGBT, just LGB. So they took away the T. The next day, a news conference, trans people, straight people, LGBTQ people, all descended on this federal monument, and they knew what was at stake, the onslaught against this community. Right through to now, words matter. When wielded maliciously by the powerful, words can harm, even kill. That's why Texas Republican Congressman Keith Self's words, chairing a recent House subcommittee hearing, deserve special condemnation. Near the hearing's end, Self recognized the committee's newest, most junior member, Delaware Democratic Congressmember Sarah McBride, the first transgender person elected to Congress, self-purposefully misgendered her. He said, "I now recognize the representative from Delaware, Mr. McBride." To which McBride replied, "Thank you, Madam Chair." Misgendering him without missing a beat. Self was immediately challenged by Massachusetts Democrat Bill Keating. He said, "Mr. Chairman, could you repeat your introduction again, please?" Self said, "Yes. We have set the standard on the floor of the House, and I'm simply..." Keating said, "What's that standard, Mr. Chairman? Would you repeat what you just said when you introduced a duly elected representative from the United States of America, please?" Self said, "I will. The representative from Delaware, Mr. McBride." Keating says, "Mr. Chairman, you are out of order. Mr. Chairman, have you no decency?" Keating added, "You will not continue with me unless you introduce a duly elected representative the right way." Self quickly adjourned the hearing. He attempted to demean McBride. His attempt to demean her was the latest abuse heaped on her since her November election win, flowing from Trump's constant incitement of anti-trans hatred to rally his MAGA base. Since Trump's inauguration, he's issued at least 8 executive orders and memoranda targeting trans people. Back in July 2023, we spoke to congressional candidate Sarah McBride, who anticipated the hostility if she were elected. She said, "Let the pettiness of these far-right wing politicians contrast with our focus on progress. Let their cruelty contrast with our compassion. Let the diversity of our humanity be more fully seen in the halls of Congress, and to help reinforce that trans people are part of the rich fabric of America, that we have something to offer, that we are talented, thoughtful, effective legislators," she said. Laws targeting transgender people are being debated in state houses nationwide. The latest data from Trans Legislation Tracker cites 738 bills, I think it's higher now, in 2025 pipeline. The number of such bills being introduced shot up exponentially in recent years. McBride explained the surge. She said, "Ultimately, these laws that seek to restrict access to medically necessary health care for transgender people are all part of a cruel and concerted agenda that's meant to distract from the fact Republicans have absolutely no policy agenda to address the needs of workers and families in this country. This is part of an ongoing strategy that the far right wing has attempted to utilize throughout generations, which is to seek to divide and conquer. Trans people are just their new target." There have been a number of lawsuits. Several have been successfully blocked. While the court battles proceed, the lives of transgender people are still at risk. Now is the time for organizing an unflinching solidarity so that facing rising authoritarianism, we don't end up, paraphrasing the anti-Nazi German theologian Pastor Niemöller, we don't end up paraphrasing him and saying, "First they came for trans Americans, but I said nothing. Then they came for me." And the place to hear the voices of people talking about their sexuality, talking about their politics, talking about their concerns way beyond their gender identity, because they're being reduced to only talking about that. It's in media. It's in that huge table that we all sit around. I wanted to end with just two quick stories. I know I have like 5 minutes. One is back in 2016, being at Standing Rock in North Dakota, because it was the largest gathering of indigenous people this country had seen in decades. It was the Standing Rock Sioux taking on the Dakota Access Pipeline, afraid that when it went under the Missouri River, the longest river in North America, it could pollute the all of the people, native and non-native, living downstream to the tune of tens of millions of people, and that it was a danger to everyone. You know, it was April 1st, 2016. That was an election year when Clinton ran against Trump. You know, in that year, Environmental issues in the presidential debates were hardly raised, let alone DAPL, the Dakota Access Pipeline, yet this historic gathering was happening. It started with the unofficial historian of the Standing Rock Sioux, LaDonna Brave Bull Allard, who would later die of cancer. But she said, you know, we have to take on this. We can't do it alone. Anyone who wants to come to help us fight the standoff at Standing Rock, I'll open my property and you can set up your teepees or your tents, whatever. And she thought a couple dozen people would come. She had enough food for them. Dozens came, then hundreds came, then thousands of people came. They set up one resistance camp after another. Democracy Now! Was out there at Labor Day weekend of 2016. We came late to it. We were reporting on it from New York, but then we got there. It was Labor Day weekend, official federal holiday, and we saw a group of people moving to a property that they said was their sacred burial ground. It was a holiday. They were shocked that they were seeing bulldozers excavating this property that was being debated in court later that week. A judge was going to rule on whether the Dakota Access Pipeline could do this, the company. And so they ran to the site. There were the bulldozers. One, two, three, four, five, six. We were running after them. We had our microphone and camera to record what was happening. It was kids. It was older women. It was older men. It was boys. They came up on the site and they stood in front of these bulldozers. This is earth-crushing, major bulldozers. Their lives were clearly threatened by this, but the bulldozer operators didn't want to threaten their lives, so they started moving back, one bulldozer after another, and the people went forward, and amazingly enough, with hundreds of people, the bulldozers were pushed back. That meant the security of Dakota Access Pipeline came out with dogs to stop the retreat. They came out with dogs, and we just kept filming. They were biting the indigenous people, the allies. We filmed a dog with his nose and mouth covered in blood. They were denying that they were macing people, which they were. People were coughing, people were running, but people were moving forward. And eventually, even the security guards pulled their dogs away. The tractor drivers, they all pulled away. So we had this incredible footage, and we posted it online. You know, when I go into the networks, MSNBC, CNN, when I've been invited in, I say, why don't you deal more with the climate issue? And they say, we want to, the host would say. But our executives say, you know, people's eyes would roll. Well, people aren't interested. Within 24 hours, there were 14 million views of this video. We went back to New York. The judge was going to rule on Friday. Well, Friday we did the show, and then Nermeen Sheikh and I, co-host on Democracy Now!, went up to Toronto. I wasn't fleeing. It was the Toronto International Film Festival. There was a film on I.F. Stone, and they featured Democracy Now!, and so we were invited to speak after. But on Thursday, they issued an arrest warrant for me. For me, we were just filming. And again, I wasn't fleeing to Canada. I didn't know they'd issued the arrest warrant. So we spoke after the film, and the next day, University of Toronto had invited me to speak. And so I was speaking. All of a sudden, I always have my phone with me. I get on my phone, it says, you're under arrest. I thought, oh my God, one of the students has hacked my phone. Like, this is supposed to scare me or whatever. Okay, this is a joke. But I see it's a North Dakota number, so I'm not so sure. And I don't want to say it out loud. This is really serious. And so I just said, could someone call me a cab? I thought I'd race to the airport. And if I could get across back to the United States before the warrant goes into the system. And so I came back to the United States, and it was true. They'd issued an arrest warrant. And we thought, think of all the young reporters who want to cover this epic showdown. They're going to be afraid. If reporters are getting arrested, they're not going to go. And we have to show them this is what the corporate media has to do also. We will stand up for freedom of the press. Showing what is taking place. I knew that when we crossed, if they you know, if you encounter FBI or Border Patrol or police, you could be in trouble if there's a warrant. But if we didn't, so I said, we're going back to North Dakota. We're going to take on this. What? They are threatening to arrest me. So as we flew back into North Dakota, as we are landing, my North Dakota lawyer, not that I had one before, called and said, as we got on the tarmac, they've dropped the charges. You know, this is embarrassing for them. They brought more serious charges. They're charging you with a felony. I said, I don't understand. If I were to serve time, how long would it be? He said, like maybe a year. I said, a year? I came here for like 3 days. Oh my God, when do I have to turn myself in, or when will I be arraigned? And he said, Monday. It was Friday. I said, okay, we have 2 days to cover the protests. So we've got a lot to get done. And we, on that morning, we broadcast right across from the courthouse so I wouldn't be late. It's the courthouse and the jail and the Ten Commandments in between. That was what it looks like in Mandan, North Dakota. So who did we interview? We interviewed the chairman of the Standing Rock Sioux at the time, Dave Archambault. I asked him, did you ever get arrested? There was some self-interest here. I wanted to know what would happen to me. And he said, yes. He said right early on, because they were so involved with civil disobedience. He was the chairman. He was like the president. He was the 45th, I think, chairman of the Standing Rock Sioux. And I said, what happened? And he said, well, they stripped me. And they put me in an orange jumpsuit, and I was jailed. And then I interviewed Dr. Sarah Jumping Eagle. She's the pediatrician of the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation. She cared about the health of children if this pipeline were to go through. She was one of the first to be arrested. I said, what happened to you? Same, stripped, put in an orange jumpsuit, and jailed. How much humiliation can a people take? And so this was now getting a lot of attention. We finished the broadcast. Hundreds of people now came. Many indigenous people came. They were standing there along the line of our broadcast truck, and I was going to have to cross the street. And then I got a call from the North Dakota Public Radio longtime host, knows every player and every scene here, and he says, the judge isn't going to do it. He's not going to sign the warrant against you. There's too much attention here. This is too hot. I mean, the New York Times, the BBC, Al Jazeera, Vogue magazine was covering this, and I didn't think I merited that, but this is why it was interesting. When the media shines a spotlight in the right direction, it wasn't just me that got off that day. There were a number of indigenous Native American people who were going to court, and their charges were dropped too. When the media sheds the spotlight in the right direction, that's what all of our goal is, to keep those microphones open, because when they are exposed to the light of day, that's when justice happens. My two final stories are Mamie Till Mobley, this remarkable woman who, after her son Emmett Till, in 1955, she sent him to be with his aunt and uncle in Mississippi to get out of the Chicago heat and to get away from the city to be safe. He's with his cousins and his aunt and uncle, and he's dragged out of his bed in the middle of the night by a white mob, and he is tortured and shackled to a weight that ends up in the bottom of the Tallahatchie River. They said he wolf whistled at a white woman. When his body was dredged up and sent back to Chicago, Mamie, his mother, this remarkable, fierce fighter, said, I want the casket open, you know, it's horribly distended, mutilated head. I want the casket open for the wake and the funeral. She wanted the world to see the ravages of racism, the brutality of bigotry, and thousands passed by his casket and saw. Mamie Till Mobley and Jet Magazine took pictures and published them, and they were seared into the history and consciousness of this country. Mamie Till Mobley had something very important to teach the press of today. Show the pictures Show the images. Broadcast the voices. Whether we're talking about the ravages of racism, the brutality of occupation, whether we're talking about U.S. troops deployed on the streets of the United States, immigrants taken in the middle of night, students having their visas revoked before they know it, learning of it as they're being arrested. When you see these images, you will say no. And I believe this of people across the political spectrum. It is critical that we expose what is happening. Stay away from the pundits. Go right to the people who are most affected and only telling their stories if they can't tell their own. If they've been taken, if their livelihoods are threatened. Which brings me at the end to the White Rose Collective, to a remarkable brother and sister named Hans and Sophie Scholl, back to World War II. Hans was a medical student at the University of Munich. Sophie was his little sister. She was a college student at the University of Munich. They weren't Jewish. They were German Christians. But they thought, what can we do in the face of the Nazi atrocity? And together with professors and other students, they decided that they would unleash a series of pamphlets so the Germans would never be able to say we didn't know. And they issued 6 pamphlets in full. And one of those pamphlets said at the top, "We will not be silent." They distributed these everywhere. In the cover of night, they would drop them in an alley at a marketplace, throw them over the atrium of the University of Munich, so all these pamphlets would flutter in the wind down to the ground. Hans and Sophie and their professor were caught. They were charged, they were tried, they were convicted, and they were beheaded. But that philosophy, that motto, should be the Hippocratic Oath of us journalists today, should be Hippocratic Oath of us all today. We will not be silent.
How do you suggest that we tell these stories when it feels like they have no qualms with killing us? You know, how do we show compassion? How do we still stay professional? How do we still give these stories out and tell the whole story and really appeal to these people who, quite frankly, don't see us as human?
Well, I so appreciate your question. It's so important. You have to stay safe, that is for sure. I think what's important is that it is more than you. That you have a team of people, and the more you broadcast the voices of the community, that whole community rallies around you. You're definitely not alone. That's the power of community media. I've always found how amazing it is. You never can predict how people actually feel, that they respond to others telling their own truths, and it just so transcends politics. And you just have to forge forward, making sure that you are being fair, you're being accurate, you're seeking out people telling their stories. If you're telling someone's story because somehow they can't tell it, that it is well sourced. And but I will not minimize that it is a very frightening time, right? You have President Trump, after the assassination attempt against him, he gave a rally where he said, you know, I have glass here, plexiglass, he said, that protects me. But I can see if you took a direct shot here, you could hit the press right there. And I said, what are you talking about? And so I don't minimize the danger. I also think that I always think of what Isabel Allende, the great writer who wrote House of the Spirits, and I just interviewed for her latest book. about another time in Chile. They have their September 11th, 1973, when the democratic leader Salvador Allende died in the palace as the Pinochet forces came to power. Unfortunately, the U.S.-backed Pinochet forces. But it was a coup decades before, similarly, fascism flourishing there. Isabel has always said, there are more of us than there are of them. For every thug in a community, there are 100, there are 1,000, there are 10,000 compañeros and compañeras who are there deeply caring about the community. It's not a matter of Democrat or Republican, or it's a matter of being human. And I think we have to express that humanity on the air. But I don't minimize your fear, but you're here for a reason. And you have important stories to tell and to let the community tell.
What role do you believe radio journalism and independent media play, not only in reporting on fascism, but actively resisting it? Thinking back to the legacy of Radio Venceremos in El Salvador, and where is the line between reporting and resistance, and when do you believe it must be crossed? Thank you.
This is a time when institutions are shutting down. The public space is shrinking. And this is the time when community radio can shine. Someone can just hear a voice on the radio and pull over to the side of the road. And that touches not only that person, but the person they tell and the person they tell. It is old-fashioned in a sense, but, you know, every media outlet is now global. It's both community, but online, it's global.org. And I think just doing that work is about resistance. I just came from New York. You know, there was a run of Good Night and Good Luck with George Clooney and Alana Glazer, and the amazing story, the telling the story of Edward Murrow and taking on the Red Scare. We are not alone in this country. All of us are speaking to people all over the world all the time. We probably have more in common with each other than we do perhaps with our governments. And really looking at places, I think of Maria Ressa, right? She won the Nobel Peace Prize for her journalism, taking on Duterte in the Philippines. And she came in a few years ago. She came in recently, too. But a few years ago, she told us about what was happening. She'd accused him of being a murderer. She had the evidence. She was really taking him on. Now he's sitting in jail. But that's beside the point, at The Hague. And his daughter is the vice president. Maria said, you know, when we walked out of the studio, she said, when I just told that story, it wasn't just a story about my country, the Philippines, and, you know, the authoritarian push of this president. This is a story for you to learn for your country, because this is what you may well see in the next few years. And, of course, she was prophetic. And that's also why it's important that we all be global. And this goes to your question, too. People are dealing with these issues all over the world, and to hear these voices, we learn from them. They're trying to erase history now. I remember when I was growing up, the librarians were very scared of the intertubes, you know, because I guess we call it the internet now, but very scared because they said, well, we always have to keep a paper copy. And I would say that's, you know, so old-fashioned. You know, digitally, it's much more also environmental. You're cutting down less trees. No, we always need a paper copy because you never know. They could change it. They could erase it. And that is what we are seeing. Did you know in the last few weeks on the White House website, they have now removed all the transcripts of President Trump? Anything he said, this is the president. I'm not talking about grassroots movements. They said the only way you can best understand him is you have to listen to the video, the audio. They understood that because of the number of lies that are put out, you then have them very easily. Not that you can't transcribe it, but they're not going to make it easy for you. And think about the universities, the grants people are writing. So many grants have been shut down. Science is so challenged now in this country, the whole investigation of the truth in every field. But it's critical that we have the record, as Robert F. Kennedy now, as health secretary, is erasing the knowledge base on everything from vaccines to cancer research to Alzheimer's. He just ended the vaccine advisory board. And then all of those records get wiped away unless we actually have records of them. And I see radio as the oral history of this country, and how important is that be protected, but not only looking back, looking forward, and ever expanding that range of voices that we bring people.
You were just listening to Amy Goodman on the power of community media. She spoke in Salt Lake City in mid-June 2025. Amy Goodman is the award-winning host of Democracy Now!, the daily syndicated radio and TV program. This program is produced by Alternative Radio. We're an independent nonprofit in our 40th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Claudia de la Cruz, Vijay Prashad, Peter Beinert, Angela Davis, Gabor Mate, and Arundhati Roy. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Amy Goodman on the Power of Community Media, and for Noam Chomsky's classic book, How the World Works, call us 1-800-444-1977. Or go online our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. To get them, just call us 1-800-444-1977. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening. We go out with Thelonious Monk, straight, no chaser.
WRCT Pittsburgh, produced by the students in Contextual Practice Seminar. The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in the show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily express those of WRCT Pittsburgh or its members.
All right, so today our guest is Simona Körner. I was going to ask you to teach me how to pronounce your name correctly.
You made it pretty well.
Okay. Yes. So we met on the first day of grad school, and we became fast friends. And I wanted to invite Simona because we met up this past weekend in Princeton at a conference called Fantasies of the People, and Nick was also there. And because of that opportunity of you coming to this country, Simona and Nick came from Germany. I thought it would be really nice to be able to spend some time together, and then for Simona to be able to share their performance practice and the work they've been doing recently with field recordings with you all. One of the things that I feel really connected with you about with your practice is how research-based it is. And with research, it expands beyond reading, right? Mm-hmm. And it's a kind of research that is about connecting with people. It's very embodied. And in your performance work, you talk about this, right? And you enact it. And I wanted you to come and be able to share that with us.
Yes, thank you for inviting me.
Yeah.
So interesting because maybe I just... We already talked about that in the car a bit, I have the feeling I was... Like, so in a kind of way anxious to come here and talk about my practice because so much changed in the last weeks, like politically, mm-hmm. And not just because of like telling or speaking out mm-hmm. about political things, but also because I have the feeling my artistic practice needs to necessarily change through that, or I have to like regain it and like it's like broken apart in pieces and now I have to like somehow pick them up again and see how to deal with them or with the forms which are somehow not so applicable anymore at some points. I mean at other points yes, but so I'm really curious about speaking with you today and also a bit like loaded. Yeah. That's what I wanted to say.
So
maybe, yeah, I brought some materials. Yeah. Like, I thought it would be nice because I see my artistic practice very much implicated in like, the practice of many others in your practice. That's why we maybe found us on the mm-hmm. first day. But also, like, historically embedded, like, in a network at some point. I brought like a recording of Louis Schulze-Zukai, from whom you maybe already heard like the presentation, the video, I don't know. I shared a text, mm-hmm. a video of Louis, who was a scholar at my, like who was a visiting artist scholar at my university in Nuremberg, ADBK Nuremberg, and from whom I learned like a lot about sound and perception and I found it interesting already in our entering round now, like that it's even not so clear what to talk about when we talk about sound. That it like so fast goes to music, that it mm-hmm. somehow draws back to the self. You came with recording techniques, and this somehow already reveals so much about the horizon one grew up in without even talking about identity. Mm-hmm. You don't need to talk about mm-hmm. where one specifically comes from, and it tells a lot about class, gender, implicatedness when you talk about how you listen or how you sound and how you perceive this. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, Luis, I brought two texts. One by Nisha Ramaya. I don't know how to pronounce her name. Maybe you
Nisha
can
Ramaya.
Which is one of my favorite poets at the moment, who writes in